You are listening to Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are. We now present the Catechism Hour, hosted by Brother Justin Bunyan.
Welcome to the Catechism Hour with me, Brother Justin Bunyan of the Heralds of the Gospel. And today we are going to revisit the virtue of prudence. As stated in our last show, the treatment we gave of prudence a few months back was a little bit cursory. And today we're going to dig a little bit deeper just to give us some more in the way of what is this mother virtue, this virtue which, without which we don't have any other virtues, but it teaches us how we are to be and what we are to be. If we can understand that, then everything else becomes a lot easier. So let's go quickly over some short definitions, and then we'll jump into some parts we have not visited yet. So the virtue of prudence is defined as an intellectual virtue which rightly directs particular human acts through rectitude of appetite and towards the good end. The emotional well-being. So prudence helps us to regulate, helps us to put into place the most important, helps us to understand our place in the universe. Without prudence, we do not know how to direct our human acts. Our appetites can be wrong. So this is why it's so important, and this is why all the other virtues depend on that, because if we do not have prudence, then in fact everything else doesn't exist. Because we have to remember that the virtue of prudence is not merely an intellectual virtue. Some virtues are. Some virtues are tied directly to the soul, tied directly to the intellect and will. But in this one here, it's more global. It has everything. For example, a moral virtue is a habit that makes the possessor good. Christ will correct the man in the Gospels where he says, only God is good. So you may say it's a virtue which makes us godlike, which St. Paul says is the end of a Christian. We're to be made like gods. We're to be made like God himself. We're children of God by adoption. One may be brilliant and learned without being morally good. How many do we have like that in our world? But it's not possible to be prudent and not morally good. So if we want to make sure that our moral compass is correct, check if we're practicing the virtue of prudence. Prudent people are not common. there are many philosophers and there's many theologians, but prudent, truly prudent people, very few, because it demands of itself. So let's go into some of the points which we have not had a chance to revisit. So I'm going to start today with integrity, right? We talk a lot about integrity. We talk about how much we want our public persons to be people that are integral, that are one, that are the monolith. The question is, do we ourselves practice it? It's great for us to want others to be, but how about ourselves? So it's natural for the human person to be inclined, so to desire, to seek integration within himself, an integration that's complex items within himself. Why? Because we seek to be more fully. We want to be one. We want that unity. We want to be good. We want beauty. We want truth. And these are very properties. These are very elements. They're very the very thing of what it is to be self. That unity begets integrity. When we're fractured, integrity doesn't live within us. So we need that element in which we have unity, which we're united. So this becomes the element in which we become truly human. It's kind of funny. We talk about sin being the human thing to do. How many arguments have you heard of people denying the Immaculate Conception of Mary, the true divinity of Christ, saying he must have sinned because to be human is to sin? But if you look at the philosophy of the human person, sin is a defect. See, sin is an absence. So therefore, to be truly human actually is to be without sin. So the most human person ever created was Mary. She was the most human because she did not have sin. She didn't have any holes. She didn't have any vacuums. Christ, as a human, was the most perfect human. Why? Because, again, there was no honeycombing inside. We ourselves are less human, and the more that we sin, we even become more so. So our next level we're going to look at are the secondary elements of the virtue of prudence. But sometimes, and you'll perceive this as we go along, the secondaries are where the keys to understanding the primary elements of the virtue are. They define it. They break it down just so much that we end up understanding the higher versions, higher forms, better. So we have to understand, for example, the good and evil. And if that part begins to resonate within our minds, then we can go on and understand a lot of other things. Temptations are in our lives, and they are part of our lives. But evil is not something that we are. And just keep that in mind, that honeycombing, that element, that hole. If we understand the hole, the missing part, then truly we understand the role of purgatory. Because purgatory is the filling in of those holes. You might say in construction, it was the concrete injections to fill in those holes so we don't have sinkholes within ourselves. So it's inconstant with a goodwill to treat certain others with preference based on pure and feeling, as well as to treat others in a way that fails to respect their status as equal and dignity to ourselves. That's pretty fascinating. Humans are essentially equal. There are accidentals, but those accidentals make this world interesting. with children, we talk about that, and one of them says, "But I like people like myself." I said, "It'd be a very boring world with only you running around." So, what are the accidentals? Accidentals are height, weight, complexion, intelligence level at times, experience. These are all accidentals. Those all can be changed. They don't change, they don't influence the very person who's in front of you. So that's why it's so terrible, so un-Catholic, when a person discriminates based on complexion or race, discriminates based on size. Because you're not looking at what the person is. You're looking at something, in a sense, which is a veneer. It's not their, not the self. One ought not, we must not treat another person as a means to an end. How many people in our world today treat others as a means, as a way to an end, and that end tends to be their own end? How many? You know, I know, it's the way the world turns, but that's un-Christ-like. So this is really important. So we have to understand that the human value is incredibly important. And in the value of prudence is of paramount value. So human good action is an action motivated by an intelligible human good. So we make actions because we know something is good. If we do not have that, then in truth, it's not good. So let's look at the first principle of morality. And in the first point of morality, we can look at some of these secondary precepts or principles that are derived from it. And then from there, we're going to flip it and look deeper. So let's go first. One must not willingly destroy an instance of an intelligible human good for the sake of some other intelligible or sensible good. We can't destroy, we have to foster. One ought not to treat another person as a means to an end. One ought not to treat certain others with preference based purely on feeling, as well as to treat others in a way that fails to respect their status as equal in dignity to oneself. One ought not to willingly act alone and individually for human goods. One ought not to act purely on the basis of emotion, either on the basis of fear, aversion, hostility, or desire. So, what is the applicator? What is the means to make sure that we can practice these points? And that's prudence. Prudence demands that one continue to ponder the implications or how it applies of the principles of morality and secondary principles of natural law. It is reasonable, and I would recommend it, to devote some time. This is important because we need to enrich ourselves to learn into studying some of the great thinkers of our Christian heritage. So, an Augustine, a Thomas Aquinas, St. Alphonsus Liguori, or the ancients such as Aristotle. Or look around at some of the great modern thinkers who take from the past and bring forward. That can help us. So, that being said, let's look at another point. And the next point is memory. If prudence is merely knowledge of universal moral principles, we could stop there. But it is such and much more than that. Prudence requires a sensitivity, an attunement to the here and now of the real world of real people. It requires a great deal of experience. That's why prudent people tend to be a little bit older. And because they've been through it, they've learned through life the know-how to make the right decision. It requires a great deal of that. That is why St. Thomas Aquinas lists memory as an integral part of the virtue of prudence. For experience is a result of many memories. There is more to memory than the simple recalling of facts. Memory is more an ability to learn from an experience. So it involves an openness to reality, a willingness to allow oneself to be measured by what is real. This quality of openness is not a widespread, as we might tend to believe at first. Some people don't seem to learn from their experiences. That is, they don't seem to remember how this or that person reacted in their particular way relating to them. For they continue to make the same mistakes in the same way relating to others. It is as if they have no memory of last week, last month, or last year. They lack a true element of being in memory because they do not will to change, to conform the way in which they want the world to be. That is why the study of history is so important for the development of political prudence. For how often have you heard the old adage that those who do not learn history are condemned to repeat its mistakes? And ourselves, how many mistakes do we make because we don't learn from what we've done in the past? Our next point is docility, or ability to learn. Those who lack memory are more likely to lack this docility. And docility is an integral part of prudence. St. Thomas Aquinas in the Summa Theologica states the following: prudence is concerned with particular matters of action, and since such matters are infinite variety, no one man can consider them all sufficiently. Nor can this be done quickly, for it requires length of time. Hence, in the matters of prudence, a prudent man stands very great need of being taught by others, especially by old folk who have acquired a sane understanding of the ends of the practical matters. So docility is an open-mindedness. It requires a recognition that one's own limitations and ready acceptance of those limits. Proud people who hope excessively in their own excellence will tend to make imprudent decisions because they fail to rely on others by the virtue of their inordinate or unrealistic self-expectation. A person with fake or false docility seeks the advice of others, but only those deemed most likely to be in agreement with themselves or with those who have similar depravity, who are thus unlikely to challenge the overall orientation of their lives. How many people have come to you, and I need help with this, but what they're looking for is for someone to rubber stamp what they're doing. And you look at it saying, that's mad. I don't know what you're doing. And they're not happy with you because you're not rubber stamping their decisions. You might have had a good experience in this matter. You might have seen or might have learned in a situation that X and Y don't equal into a Z, but this person is set on that desire. So it's important for us to continue to look at prudence as a necessary toolkit for ourselves, so that when we ourselves encounter difficulties, we have the humility to go and look for people, wiser people. Wiser people, people who know, and those who know, we can then learn from them. The Psalms tell us, go to every wise man and learn from them. But is it that our humility is insufficient? Is our pride too great? So our next one is to look at the English word of shrewdness. Shrewdness is the ability to quickly size up a situation on one's own. And so it involves the ability to pick up small clues and run with them. The shrewd are highly intuitive. They're subtle and they're discreet. The shrewd teacher, for example, will pick up subtle clues to reveal just who it is he is or she is dealing with in her classroom and what needs the children, the students, really are, which allow them to determine quickly the approach best suited for their particular way of learning. The shrewd are able to detect evil behind the guise of goodness, so as to be able to plan accordingly. Some people are dangerously unsuspecting of the motives of evil, and so they miss the clues that suggest a more ominous picture. For we tend to see in others what we see in ourselves. If our motives are good, it is hard to suspect others of malice. Moreover, excessive empathy has a way of clouding the intuitive light of shrewdness. But just as memory and docility presuppose a good will, the right appetite, the good desire, so too does shrewdness. It can be the case that the inability to see is rooted in a will not to see. How many people are like that? They're blind because they're blind because they want to be blind. For sometimes people would rather not think about what the clues could mean for fear of what they might discover about someone or something, which in turn will affect their security in some way. As the old saying goes, there are none so blind as those who will not see. It can also be the case that a person has not learned to listen to their intuition and perhaps confuses a negative intuition with judging the heart of another, and so dismisses the intuition and its insights, especially negative ones. On the other hand, it is possible that a person wants to see evil where there really is none. This is not shrewdness, but suspicion. It is often rooted in the spirit of pride. So we see this good shrewdness, this ability to read what's going on around you. And that ability to read is important because with that reading, we're able to do the work of God. But making sure that we're not overly judgmental, that we're not trying to go where we're not supposed to go, and make sure it doesn't become this really rude form of suspicion. Because suspicion is terrible because it destroys human relationships. So once a person sizes up a situation, he needs to be able to investigate and compare the alternative possibilities and to reason well from premise to a conclusion. That's important. This is the point of reasoning. We need to be able to reason about what needs to be done. That is, what the best alternative or option is that will realize the right end. Prudence presupposes a knowledge of the basic logic of reasoning. If a person cannot see through a common logical fallacy, straw man fallacy, begging the question, what have you, it's unlikely that he's going to make prudent questions. So what's begging the question? Begging the question is when we assume a point that needs to be still proven. Or we ignore the question, which consists of proving something other than the point that's been established. A false cause consists in assuming that when one event precedes another, it is the cause of succeeding events. So we have all of these things. For example, the fallacy of the ad hominem attack, in which we don't attack the problem, we attack a person, which is unjust. So with all of that, we have to see with prudence. We don't judge with our emotions. We judge with our minds. God gave us reason for that purpose. We look, we judge, we act. It isn't that we look, we act, then judge. That is a person who lacks prudence. And we need to practice prudence for the good of our lives and for the lives of those who are around us. So we're going to go to a break now. And after the break, we're going to continue looking at this right reasoning and how that can help us in our day-to-day lives, both in our communities, but also within our families. Be back in a quick moment's time.
You are listening to the Catechism Hour here on Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are. To contact us, you can tweet us at Radio Maria Can or email catechismhour@radiomaria.ca.
Welcome back. Let's continue looking at the virtue of justice and how it has strict relations with ourselves and building up in ourselves this monolith of Christianity within ourselves, and how we're avoiding this breaking, this fractionization of ourselves. Through sin, we break ourselves also, but sin is a very generic word. So we're looking at the particular cracks which take apart that granite, which is our soul. So as I already said, I am my word. My word is an extension and expression of myself. So when I split my word and my inner self, we have that image very clear. Okay, let's continue. In lying, I gradually lead myself downward towards a pseudo-form state of mental illness. That is, towards a divided self. I end up becoming a spiritual bipolar or schizophrenic. Because I know truth and I deny truth. And I don't know anymore what's true and what's not true. And when that happens, nothing good can come from it. There are all sorts of motives for lying, none of which can and will justify it. By lying, might have a charm of its own. It might make me feel appealing. One who lies has something that no one else has. That is, he knows something the others do not. There is something that belongs only to him and that no one can take away because others are not even aware that they don't have it and that they've been deceived. Thus, one who lies has created a space that is his own and no one can invade. This provides, in some last degree at last, a feeling of power over others, a feeling of being in control. But there's a price to the creation of the space. And what it is, namely, is the disintegration of your character. Because lying involves a splitting of self, it creates a distinct and distance between myself and I. As I continue to lie, which is inevitable since we create habits, we already spoke about this in the past, habits, bad acts that we do consistently, we gradually lose ourselves. And at some point, perhaps after years, I may lose myself. And I am so far aware, and I'm not aware of it anymore. At this point, I can lie to myself and even believe my own lies. The Russian novelist, famous for his works on morality, Dostoevsky, speaks of this particular state of affairs in the great novel, The Brothers Karamazov. A man lies to himself, believes his own lies, becomes unable to recognize truth, either in himself or in others. He ends up losing respect for himself as well as for the others. When he has no respect for anyone, he can no longer love. And in order to divert himself, having love for no one, including himself, he yields to his impulses. He indulges in the lowest forms of pleasure and behaves, in the end, like an animal to satisfy his basest vices. And in it, all comes from lying, lying to others, lying to oneself. A man who lies to himself, for instance, can take offense whenever he wishes, for there are times when it is rather pleasant to feel wronged. Don't you agree? So a man may know very well that no one has offended him, may invent an offense, lie just for the beauty of it, to exaggerate that someone said to create a situation, making a mountain out of a molehill. And although he is well aware of himself, he nevertheless does not feel offended because he enjoys doing so. He derives great pleasure from it. He comes to feel real hostility towards the imaginary offender. The one who lies becomes unable to recognize the truth because he violates the truth for the sake of the useful. He has become a pragmatist. His criterion for moral truth has become the useful, the practical. And that the liar gradually loses respect for himself as well as for others is not hard to show. For lack and loss of respect for oneself is part and parcel of every vice. The reason is that evil is a privation of being, privation of ourselves. What is evil lacking is the fullness of being. Goodness is the fullness of being. Accordingly, an evil action is lacking something which he ought to have. Now, justice is in the will, and so injustice involves a deficient will. But we are what we will, and so an unjust man is a deficient man. I cannot love deficiency. I can only love the good. So the more I commit acts of injustice, such as lying, the less there is in me to love. Thus, the more I loathe myself. How many liars have we known in our lives who loathe themselves? And their lives are full of lies, and they end up falling into depression because of this. So horrible. And if lying establishes an inequality between myself and the person whom I'm lying, then I can only lose respect for that person, since I have made him or her less than myself, whom I have begun to loathe already. There is no circumstances that can change the nature of a lie, rendering it a good action. Under normal circumstances, there is a moral debt to express oneself truthfully to others in speaking and writing. If we have the duty to withhold information from others, and that's known as mental reservation, at least we have a duty not to lie to them. To lie is to violate the requirement to treat others in a way that respects their status as people equal in dignity to ourselves. So lying is against justice. And I hope this is very clear. So our next point we're going to look at is the ethics of killing and double effect. Human life is a basic, intelligible human good, not an instrumental good. Human person is the crown of the physical universe and willed into existence by God for his own sake. There is a sense in which he is a part of the social whole, but the human person is not related to the social whole, like a kidney or some other organ related to the whole physical organism. For kidneys, the heart, lungs, are nothing but parts, not a whole substance unto themselves. The human person is a whole unto himself, not merely a part of the social whole. An unrational animal is a whole substance unto itself, but it does not exist for its own sake, but for the sake of other human goods. Non-rational animals are not moral agents and are not measured by the obligation of justice, and thus they are not subjects of rights. An animal does not have the right not to be killed by another animal, whether the same species or not, nor does it have the right not to be killed by a man because of moral agency. A cougar stalks its prey, eats it. He's not a murderer. A cougar might kill another cougar, might eat another cougar, not a cannibal. Why? Because of this very point. Man, on the other hand, is a subject of right, of justice. Through the power of self-reflection, we know our existence as a good in itself and for itself, and we love our own existence for its own sake. We naturally will to be treated as an end, that is, we naturally desire to be loved for our own sake. We object to being used. The thought of being evaluated merely as a basis of how useful we are to another is it repugnant. We judge this contrary to our dignity as persons to be loved on our own sake. In other words, human life is intrinsically good, and we readily see this in our own case. To murder someone is to will that he or she not be. But a human person is intrinsically good, not a good relative to me or my personal ends. To will that what is intrinsically good, namely a person who is my equal, not to be set one's will against what is humanly or intrinsically good, such is an evil will. It is precisely this relationship between the will and the human person, when it bears down upon the differences between murder and killing. A dog, for example, is not capable of murder because a dog does not have a will, only a sensitive appetite. A dog can only kill. In a man's case, not every act that leads to death of a person is murderous. For example, a woman picks up a metal bar, swings it in order to stop someone who is approaching with wielding a knife with evident intent to kill her, is not necessarily acting with murderous intent should her action lead to the attacker's death. What is intended or willed is the swinging of the metal bar that is to have that attacker stopped, not killed. We have a duty to try to stop the attacker because our life is intrinsically good and ought to be protected. We even use lethal force to stop an attacker. For often the only way to disarm an aggressor who holds a victim in his grip and a gun to its head is to shoot them in the back of the head. To do this is not necessarily to involve one in willing his death, even though one knows that death is virtually inevitable. There is a fundamental difference between intending an effect and accepting an effect, and its undesirable consequences to an otherwise good action. A few simple examples can help us with this. It is inevitable that the more we drive, the more our tires will be worn. The more we use our cars, the more the car may break down. We don't will this or intend it, but we do accept it as an inevitable fact of life. Matter has a natural propensity to change. Separating Siamese twins might very well lead to the death of one of the twins, but choosing to proceed with the operation does not necessarily involve a person in willing the death of the twin that dies. The surgeon may very well accept the death of one twin as an undesirable result of the surgery, without intending their death. But, and this is where things change, aborting a child in the womb does involve the intention to destroy it. That is why the abortionist is going in with his forceps to clamp onto the child, to tear it apart so that it no longer will be. Such an action is murderous. We see the intention. Consider the difference between the action and the action of clamping down on the artery of the fallopian tube during an ectopic pregnancy. What does the surgeon intend to do? So, he intends to prevent hemorrhaging, but this action at the same time kills the developing human life in the fallopian tube. There is not something he wills or intends, but it is something he accepts as inevitable, an undesirable side effect of a certain medical procedure. Now, it should be pointed out that it does not follow that just because an action does not involve an intention to do evil, only the acceptance of the evil effect, that the action is morally justified. Before one may proceed with an act that has a good effect,
and an evil effect, a number of conditions must be placed. These are known as the rules of double effect. Firstly, the action to be formed must be good, or at least morally indifferent. Two, one must not positively will an evil effect, only permit it or allow it. Three, the good effect must proceed from the action and not from the effect. Otherwise, one would be doing evil that good may come of it. And finally, the good effect must be significantly desirable, a good enough to compensate for permitting the evil. The fourth condition is most important. There ought to be certain proportion between the good and evil effect. It is justified for a police officer to use his gun on a boy threatening him with a slingshot? I don't think so. The good effect is that the officer will save himself from a possible black eye. Ought he to accept the possible death of the child for the sake of the effect? Clearly not. So we have to have great differences between the two points. A little boy runs after you with a stick. You pull out a shotgun. No, that doesn't make sense. Moreover, we ought to be careful when employing the word proportionate in the context of ethics. This is a huge discretion and discussion on the question of ethics, proportionate. The reason is that some philosophers have developed a theory of morality called proportionalism. And that is inconsistent with the principles of prudence. The typical proportionalist holds that one may do evil to achieve good, as long as the good resulting from the act is proportionate to the evil being done. This is, however, not what we are advocating here. One must and may never do evil that good may come of it. For you are what you choose. By choosing evil as a means, one becomes an evil character, at least in part. Consider the case, and I'm going to close with this today, of Saint Gianna Molla. Towards the end of her second month of her pregnancy, it was discovered that she had developed a defect in her uterus. Would it be justified for her to have an abortion, as it was recommended to her, in order to save her own life? Certainly not in her mind, and certainly not according to the principles of natural law. Her case is not a double effect scenario. The good effect might be sufficiently desirable to compensate for allowing the evil effect, but aborting a child is not a case of allowing a child to die, but it is rather a case of making a baby die by abortion, which includes willing and intending its death. It is to do evil that good may result. Saint Gianna Molla was ready to give her life for her child. And I quote, "If you must decide between me and the child, do not hesitate. Choose the child," I insisted. "Save him." 7 days after the birth of her child, Gianna Molla was dead. The virtue of justice, the more we dig into it, the more we perceive that it's difficult. But the more that it makes us more human, makes us more of what we are called to be. We're called not to be cracked stone that has these fissures cracking to its foundations. We are called to be monoliths, monoliths of truth, monoliths of integrity. We're called to be integral people. And in being integral people, we're called to this greater, which is to be other Christs. Christ was integral. Even his enemies, we find this in the Gospels, couldn't accuse him of hypocrisy when he called them hypocrites. Could not find anything to throw on him except for the fact that he was merciful. And he was just and he was good. And they didn't like the various elements of his doctrine, but they couldn't condemn him for it. So for ourselves, we are called to a life of justice. And our next show, we're going to continue in it. And we're going to be touching some other subjects. Namely, the general justice or legalistic justice of the human person. what is personhood, and then the question of social justice. But we're going to begin, well, actually, it's one point, which is can be touchy in our world that we live in today, which is adultery. Because adultery is a sin against justice again. So there's justice is so much. There's so much to it. And there's so many pieces that when we say, I want to practice the cardinal virtue of justice, I want to practice the cardinal virtue of prudence, do we know what it is? And hopefully this will give us an opportunity to begin to examine ourselves and to pluck out those deficiencies, those holes, those fissures, fill them up so that we become once again what we're called to be as integral people, not broken, not shattered. And in that brokenness, we can crawl back to God and confess our sin, but also in confessing, reaching out to him on the cross. Though he was broken, he brought us salvation. So justice is key. We look in the litany of the Sacred Heart. We look in the litanies of Our Lady. And justice comes up several times. Mirror of justice is a term for Our Lady. But our Lord has many more. So let's look at it, pray it, and also look within ourselves to make sure that we're not abysses of lies and injustice, and that we actually truly do what we're supposed to do in our lives. Not just because others will say things, but because when we die, we face Christ, the judge, the just judge, who will judge us according to our actions, according to our things that we did through thought, word, deed, and omission. And either will say to us, come to the heavenly kingdom or be gone from me. I do not know who you are. So we'll continue our next episode on the same subject, but it's interesting for you to do your own reading. We're quoted from the book by Donatsky, which is The Brothers. And The Brothers is a fabulous book. It's a little depressing because there's the good guy who's kind of an idiot. And then there's the bad guy who is filled with lies. Everything's a lie. And unfortunately, when we study that book, normally people find themselves broken between the two characters. And in that brokenness, it makes for a very good discussion. So if you're looking for a book to read this period of time, you might want to pick up Brothers, give it a read, and apply the principles that we've been going through today onto the characters. And you'll end up having a very, very great conversation. So with that said, hopefully may God help us all. And when we get back next episode, we'll continue that drilling in deep to figure out what is social justice? And who is the social and who are we being just to? So may God bless you, and we'll be back next time. God bless.
You have been listening to the Catechism Hour, hosted by Brother Justin Bunyan, here on Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are.